1924. A young Washington lawyer in the Department of Justice is named director of the scandal-ridden Bureau of Investigation. His name, John Edgar Hoover. That is when the scandal stopped. The new director met the first of many challenges and won. A few years later, when the name of the organization was changed to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, its reputation, like its seal, stood for fidelity, bravery, and most of all, integrity. It still does.
Thomas Paine Podcast, Episode 6. So much stuff to talk about this episode. I got this buddy, we'll just call him Hamilton because he's not a conservative, but he's a great guy and he's given me a lot of advice on the podcast. And I think if I used his whole name, they'd probably firebomb his house. So we'll just call him Hamilton. If you hear that noise in the background, I have my first in-studio guest ever today. It's my German Shepherd, Sully. She decided to come with me to the studio. So if you hear him milling around in the back, breathing heavy or moving around, that's her. There she goes. Sit down, so you're all right. What a dog. The best dog ever. She gets a little upset, though, when I start dropping the F-bombs. She thinks that she did something wrong. Anybody who knows things about shepherds, they internalize family strife like they're responsible. So if she starts howling and barking, we might have to let her out of the studio if I start dropping the F-bombs in unison. Hamilton tells me, I reached out to him this week with some of the results of the podcast and the numbers that are coming in, which are absolutely through the roof. I don't even understand what's happening. And he points out something very interesting. He says, the regular guys can compete now with the billionaires. And that is a pretty scary thing to a lot of these media companies that are owned by billionaires and controlled by billionaires, and the message is controlled by billionaires, and it's the same folks always on the same shows and the same message and this revolving cast of characters. You never see anybody different. Everything's very controlled. Hamilton says you can pierce the veil with podcasts. You don't have to be the same old group, the same old money, the same old cycle. And he's right. So the numbers came out on the last podcast, and it's absolutely crazy. After 4 or 5 weeks of just shooting the shit on here, we go from like unknown to top 10 in daily news, competing with, well, we bypassed like ABC News and CNN, and Rush Limbaugh was up 12 or 13. We passed him. His podcast, not his regular stuff, obviously, to be in the top 10 of daily news, which is the main category I wanted to be in, because a lot of these commentary shows, it's very boring. And they're like, today we'll be talking to Devin Nunes, who's in charge of the, who fucking cares about that? You can get that anywhere. Get that on Fox. That's why people watch Fox, right? I don't want to talk to those dummies. I have so little respect for Congress on either side of the aisle. Why would I want to bore an audience? I mean, trying to build an audience, why would I want to bore them with these robots that come in here?
Yeah, so I think that what we need to do is
beat it. Go find somebody else. Go talk to one of those dopes on Fox. Anyway, the numbers of this podcast are through the roof, and it happened a lot faster than I thought it would. Everybody's been telling me for a long time, you got to do a podcast, you got to get out there. I'm like, yeah. So things are moving very well to be in the top 10. It's been holding there for the, it was at 18, then 11, then 9, and today it's 9 or 10. It's definitely hanging out in that area for the last couple of days. That's good. It's good to get a jump start and a good head start when we're starting out. But I think one of the reasons the podcast will continue to do well is that it's focused on government corruption. And that's something that doesn't discriminate when it comes to party lines. It affects every one of us, and Democrats, conservatives, they don't look at this in Washington, D.C., the insiders and the elites. They don't look at this as a two-party system like we're taught in school. And then we're forced into that way of thinking our adult lives. They're running these scams together. They're making money together. Republicans side by side with Democrats. Then they pretend like there's some type of a separation and, oh, we have to do this, we have to do that. After the cameras are off, folks, the scripts are put away and the lights go off, there's no more lights, camera, action. These guys are out drinking together with reporters, yucking it up, laughing. Republicans, Democrats, it doesn't matter. They have their arms around each other, belly laughing, cackling. Because they know they got to play you for another day. We have to stop thinking of this country as a two-party system. It's more of a two-societal system. You have the elites and you have you. And if you're not in their club, regardless of how much money you may make or how successful you consider yourself or what you've achieved in life, if you're not in the club, you're not one of them. And that means the rules that they get to break, shatter, the Constitution they get to shred on a daily basis, that doesn't work for you. You have to abide by all the laws and the Constitution. When you step out of line, they will have you locked up. That's the way it works. That's what I mean by two societal system in the United States. Corruption is a cancer in this country, and it needs to be eradicated. It's as simple as that, and it's celebrated for the most part in Washington, D.C. This is a rigged game, folks. We're starting to realize, I think many people are starting to realize, this is a rigged, tilted playing field, not in your favor. This is not in your favor. Not in any regard is it in your favor. And here's my dog. She's on the move. Even she knows there's something wrong. My dog. That's going to be a recurring theme on this podcast, that things are rigged. And we're going to get to a lot of things today, but I just wanted to open up with that. Man, there's so much to talk about. What's this clip he was talking about? Let's play this again. I think it was missing a clip. I think we're missing a part here. Hold on.
The time is 1924. A young Washington lawyer in the Department of Justice is named director of the scandal-ridden Bureau of Investigation. His name, John Edgar Hoover. That is when the scandal stopped. The new director met the first of many challenges and won. A few years later, when the name of the organization was changed to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, its reputation, like its seal, stood for fidelity, bravery, and most of all, integrity. It still does.
I think they left out the crickets. It's like, you're speechless after that, right? And it still does. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to keep it quick and dirty this episode on the plugs because we have so much to pump out here and a lot of interesting stuff in this episode. FBIPajamas.com. That's where you can buy my book, How We Dismantled the FBI in Our Pajamas, on Amazon. We're offering a deal. You buy a book, you send us a screenshot of the book to promo@truepundit.com. We send you a $50 gift card for hats and hoodies and whatever else you want to buy at libertyoutfitters.co. Pretty tough to beat. Buy a book, get $50 back. Plus, you get to see everything that's in this book. There's literally frightening information in this book. you read the reviews online. as well on Amazon. So it's FBIPajamas.com. That's how you can help us out. If you support and like what we're doing, we appreciate it. Pick up the paperback copy. So that's the plug. If you want to benefit what we're doing here, you want to benefit the investigative reporting that we've been doing, that's the best way to do it. And we encourage people to grab a copy of that book while you still can. And I'll tease this right here, something coming up in this episode, an impromptu interview we did on the fly with a telecom CEO. And he just drops a hammer. He just drops a bank safe on the back of the heads of the FBI, the DOJ, and the federal bench, the federal judges. You have to hear this. It's absolutely a classic impromptu on-the-fly interview. I didn't expect to be doing it. It just kind of materialized when we were recording the first portion of this. And we're playing it in the second half of the show because in its entirety, basically unedited, we're just rolling it. So you get an idea of what's really going on out there. And this interview is off the charts. I can't even describe it accurately. And it's not overhype. You have to hear this. Very explosive interview. People are also going to get a glimpse of how we work on the fly here. This interview is so powerful on so many levels. And what this man has to say is absolutely devastating on so many different fronts. You're also going to get to see how we develop information on the fly and how fast we can get intel and how we can get people to open up. I've done this throughout my career. I don't know if it's a gift, a skill, what it is, but I've always been able to do it. You get a raw glimpse into what's going on in the DOJ, the FBI, the federal bench. We're happy to bring it to you, and I'm excited for you to hear this. So stay tuned later in the show. There's a lot of stuff to tackle today, so let's just jump right into it. For instance, last week we talked about this major Hillary Clinton scheme with the State Department and stealing billions of dollars and siphoning billions of dollars from taxpayer money, and we put a story out on True Pundit. I just want to talk about this because we're going to have so much more coming out on this, and it's literally frightening. 30 plus years of covering corruption, local, state, federal, chasing bad guys, uncovering schemes, never seen anything this size. And we're going to get into this in the next several weeks and on the next several podcasts. And this could be a recurring theme as well because it's so massive. We can't cover these things in like 1 hour spurts or 1 hour and 10 minute spurts or whatever the show ends up being. But I talked to a guy this weekend, plugged into Justice, very high ranking guy. And he, let me grab my notes. I'm going to tell you, what he had to say was literally scary. He calls this a nuclear bomb of a scandal. He said, this is a quote. This is a cartel. It's organized crime at the highest level. And part of the problem is that these prosecutors will never figure it out. And they may not want to figure it out. You see the stuff that's breaking this week, like the new shiny new object. And on the Democratic side, they're talking about how great John Bolton is now, the guy that they have excoriated for years, and how he's going to come in and save the day and bail out their impeachment. That's on the left. And on the right, they're saying, hey, wait a minute. The real story here is Hunter Biden got paid $1 million from Burisma in Ukraine. And so these are like the two shiny talking points of the week. They're both bullshit. Number one, okay? Fucking Bolton is a Bushite. Bushite, however the fuck you say it, right? He is a Bush-era cover-up artist. He's a rat. He's been a rat. I don't know how the hell he got into the White House. Like I said, whoever is vetting the White House inner circle for Trump should be fired. Or stuffed in the back of a car, in a trunk, put on the car train in Virginia, and you can wake his ass up in Florida, right? 3 or 4 days later, or however long it takes to get from Virginia to Florida on Amtrak, it probably takes 3 weeks because the government runs it, and figure out that he's no longer welcome in the White House, or maybe it's a she. I don't know. I don't know who gets Bolton into the White House why Trump thinks that's a good idea. That's another side issue, okay? So the left is, their patron saint of the week is Bolton, who is a rat. It's like he's, this poor man's Wilford Brimley is going to save the day for them. Okay, all right, sure. On the other side, the GOP is saying, the real story here is Hunter Biden took $1 million from Burisma, and it was a payoff. $1 million. The Bidens don't leave the house for $1 million. $1 million is a pittance. It's nothing, okay? Both of these stories are smoke screens. These are fucking smoke screens meant to mislead you, and that's what it's doing for a lot of people. Let me put this into simple terms so you understand what's going on. They, the Democrats, and some of their friends, maybe even GOP folks, okay, but the Obama administration, Hillary, the Bidens, and many others, it may go all the way up to the top before it's all over, okay? They fleeced multiple countries, multiple companies of, including the United States government, of billions of dollars. This is no longer millions. This is in the billions. So when some politician, even Ted Cruz, was talking about, rambling about it today, about Hunter Biden getting $1 million, that's a fucking joke. That's a fucking joke. This is billions of dollars. If somebody in D.C. is saying, hey, this guy got $1 million, that's a cover for much more than $1 million. These guys moved out of the million neighborhood a long time ago. $1 million is like what somebody in state government takes. Your state house, somebody bilked somebody for $1 million, right? This is billions. And there's more than one corrupt member of the Biden family. And there's more than one country than Ukraine. So if they were doing this in Ukraine, don't you think that they would duplicate this scheme in other countries? They did. And they did it with other people and other corporations, other nonprofits. They ripped them off. And the people who got ripped off are not happy about it. They want their fucking money back. This isn't Fantasy Island. Mr. fucking Rourke and the midget doesn't come down and say, the plane. Guess what? The plane better be filled with my money. I want it back. Or it's going to be trouble. And that's why the scheme known as the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Global Initiative, is collapsing. Because everybody's pissed and people are talking. I don't know if this is going to lead to indictments. I don't know. Like I said, over my head. But it's going to come out. This is what we're talking about. So when you hear somebody in D.C. say, oh, he took $1 million. Bullshit. These fucking guys are professional thieves. They don't get out of bed unless it's way more than $1 million. Give me a break. These guys are pros, man. $1 million. That's like a joke. That's like going down to fucking Wawa and getting a cup of coffee and a sandwich. $1 million. Come on, man. Get real. These guys are all covering for each other. This is a massive scheme. That's why they want to get him out. They want him out of D.C. They want Trump out. Everything to go back to normal. Everybody can start relaxing. Don't have to worry about all that foreign aid you're giving out to countries. You know, most Americans sit around, hey, why the fuck do we give money to these countries? I don't get it. We got poor kids in this country, right? We got kids who can't put two pieces of bread together in the fucking morning for a sandwich. We got swelling homeless population in many urban centers, especially Los Angeles, to the point where it's bordering on decay and disease spreading. Okay, plague. This is like the fucking Roman Empire. And plague would break out in different quarters. Right? How long ago was that? We have a deteriorating infrastructure. Cities, bridges, everything, right? We have so many problems. we have veterans that don't have a place to live. We have veterans and regular folks, by the way, can't afford decent health care. Guys who are living, girls who are living in pain because they can't afford basic dental care. And it's affecting their health. They got nowhere to go, so they suffer. Maybe they get a bottle of booze, try to make the pain go away for a little bit. And then people say, oh, these guys are drunk. Really? You think maybe all these things are related in a way? Okay. We have all these problems. And then we come to find out that there are millions of dollars ending up in the pockets of these politicians. Not 1 million, millions. Because they're stealing the foreign aid and getting kickbacks, laundering the money. That's what's going on here. Ever since I was a kid, I always wondered, what the fuck are we giving these people money for? What the fuck did they do for us? They don't do anything. This is a scheme. This is a scheme we're being played. The money doesn't even go to the people. What we're working on now, folks, the Clintons, they siphoned billions from the U.S. Treasury, and we're going to get into it, and other places. And it was laundered through different places, and they took donations from other companies and other countries in the name of medical needs, helping other countries, third world countries, Africa, India, helping them get vaccines, different diseases, HIV, all kinds of things. It was all bullshit. 80% of the money that was poured in went into people's pockets one way or the other. It didn't go to medicine. They were selling fucking placebos in many instances where they even gave a shit enough to pretend that there was a product. Other times they didn't deliver anything. They just took the money. That's where this foreign aid is. That's since I was a kid. I couldn't figure out why are we giving all this money away to these people in these countries. Nothing ever seems to get better. And what about the people at home? Hey, a lot of people might not know this. I grew up, okay? This is like a sensitive issue to me. My old man left. My mom was in a lurch. 3 kids. No college for her. Right? She was a supermarket cashier at ShopRite in Philly. Suburban Philly. Delaware County. And we didn't have shit. Right? We ended up in government housing. Section 8 housing. Till she could get back on her feet. And it took her a long time. Right? When you're making 12 grand a year, you got 3 kids. How the hell are you supposed to put bills together? Okay? So this stuff is like very close to me. And I see these folks in other countries getting billions of dollars in U.S. aid. The fuck about me? What about my mom? What about my brother and my sister? What about us? What are we, fucking lepers over here? Don't understand it when you're a kid and your mom comes home and she's... You see your mom come home every day, shot to shit. Right? Standing at a register 10 hours a day. Back then, they didn't have these fancy fucking, you know, the doors of the supermarket open and a blast of heat counters a blast of cold. You stand there freezing all day wearing 6 fucking layers. There were no scanners back then either. Well, there were toward the end, but you have to key punch everything. You're wearing like fingerless gloves. Standing 10 hours a day, you get like a half an hour fucking break. And she's doing this basically all on one leg. She had polio as a child. And of course, she survived it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But she had polio as a child. And she had one good leg. Her other leg was so banged up from the polio. It was like half the size of her good leg. And she had to wear 2 different size shoes and all that. Comes home, shot the shit. See this every day. People like, and then people are in foreign countries getting billions of dollars. And you come to find out growing up now, oh, That's because these guys were making kickbacks on it. These guys in D.C. taking our money, my mom's money, out of her paycheck, into their pockets. You grow up, you realize it. It's rigged. No wonder, you know, every day you see this happen with your mom. You're living in not great conditions. But I have to tell you, the people had good friends back then. The people were good. We didn't have much. None of us had much, but, you know, we got along. I could roll right outside the door and say, hey, fuck it, yeah, my mom's all banged up again, you know. I tell you, the dog is looking at me. She knows I'm getting pissed. She's going to start fucking howling. We're scratching to get out of the room because she knows. She's seen that look before, you know what I mean? You go out and you say, yo, hey, how's it going, you know, even with, like, the brothers, right? I got along with white, black, Puerto Rican, Italians, Irish, doesn't matter. We're all in the same shitty boat. We're all dealt the same shitty deck. We're all living in, like, squalor. We're poor, okay? So you go out, and it doesn't matter if the dude's black or white. He's like, hey, what's going on? Yeah, my mom came home. She's all banged up again from work, and it's fucked up. So, you know, let's go get, like, a 40. Let's go get a 40, a Miller or something, High Life. Back then, you said the Miller High Life and Old English 800, and we used to roll with that stuff. We were, like, kids, but everybody had an older brother or an uncle, or you could put together a dollar for a fucking 40 ounce and you go have a couple pops and take off thing. Meanwhile, your mom's at home. She's got to get up and do it all over again tomorrow. It literally takes a lifetime in this racket to figure out everything that's going on. It crosses multiple generations, multiple decades, and you see the patterns and you go back and you take your personal experiences and then you combine them with what you read about history, who you talk to, who you know, the schemes you've seen. These aren't incredibly complex schemes. I mean, they're very sophisticated in many instances, but a scheme is a scheme. Certain elements to every scheme, small, large, basically certain elements. When someone's trying to steal money, or many similar things, no matter how large the money is or how small the money is. Now, through the years, able to put together a very large puzzle piece that this is stacked against us. They're ripping us off. It's crazy. That's why they want him out. They want him out of D.C. The lid comes off this foreign aid thing. I think it's going to come off. I think we have many pieces of stuff going on in Norway now. There's big problems. There's stuff going on in Geneva, Switzerland, not Pennsylvania. It's all over the world. Australia, New Zealand. Okay? It's all coming to a head. These people all chipped in. They all thought that they were going to be bettering the world through these nonprofits. Pumped up by the Clintons, and they got played, and people were pissed. It's going to come out. And what we're going to see is, you might not want to realize it, that we've all been played. Beautiful people are full of fucking shit. And they're beautiful people and they're all world when they're stealing and spending your money, not their own. You'll notice that. Most of these guys will beat their chest and, you know, stand on a milk crate and profess to the world how great they are when they're spending your money. At the same time, they're stealing it behind the scenes, putting it in their own pockets. So then if they do kick in their own money, it wasn't theirs to fucking begin with. It's crazy. It's come full circle. It takes a whole lifetime to realize this scheme. And it takes massive context. I'm fortunate, you know, been around, made a lot of friends. They talk. People talk, you put the puzzle pieces together. I'm sitting here putting puzzle pieces together and I'm giving them to people saying this is a lot larger than Hunter Biden making a fucking measly $1 million. It's like a joke. You know what I mean? That's like you going down to the store and grabbing a $7 bouquet of flowers for your wife. That's like, that's what $1 million is to this crew. I know there's a lot of people out there that can relate with what I'm saying about your parents working themselves to the bone. You got grandparents. You got, this is like, we're fucking salt of the earth here getting played. It has to stop. We give, right? And where do we get is what I'm trying to say. And that it's not just, oh, you know, this is one or two people who took some liberties and broke some laws. No, it's worse than that. It's an entire system, an entire societal split. There are two different societies in this country. There's the protected class, the elites, the folks that are ripping us off and that allow their friends to rip us off. And no one goes to jail. Then there's us, the dopes who are paying and underwriting the corruption. And we have to abide by a different set of laws. Things are different for us. That's what I call rigged. It's much bigger than you may have ever realized. Because it's much bigger than I've ever realized. When you look at this amount of foreign aid we give to countries. Like I said, it's all making sense now. Things that never made sense when I was a kid in high school, college, always asking these professors, why do we give so much money to these foreign countries? Because we are the greatest country in the world. And that's what you do. And it's like, really? No, you just didn't know what the fuck you were talking about. And you didn't want to admit it. You know, you're lied to in school. Maybe you're not lied to on purpose, but you're misled. It turns out this money's flowing around so everybody can put it in their pockets and go down to D.C., okay, not have two fucking nickels to rub together when they get elected, and voila. Within years, their kids are going to Gonzaga, 60, 70 a pop high school, private high school. They got the second home somewhere, you know what I mean? Maybe in Maryland, they got a second home on the water. They got a second home in Killington, Vermont, somewhere else, maybe out in Colorado, in Aspen. Steamboat Springs, Colorado Springs, who knows? They like to ski. They got a couple homes. What did McCain have, five homes? Pelosi, four, five homes, right? They got all this stuff going and make $150,000 a year salary. But they live in D.C., one of the most expensive places to live per capita in the United States. The cost of living, driving nice cars, they have beautiful homes, kids go to the best schools, and they're making $150, $160 a year, plus some expenses. Really, how do you do that? They should quit their job in Congress and give a fucking seminar, right? These guys make Tony Robbins look like fucking Richard Simmons. It's unbelievable. Here's the kicker, right? You grow up in that situation and you see that, you know what, I got to go to college, man. My mom's like, she's out here on an island all along. It's all about education. I don't want to end up like that. I don't want to be able to provide for my family and stuff, right? I need to go to college. I got to get some fucking student loans. Let's go. Make this happen. I got to get out of school. Got to set myself up to have a better life. We didn't have a lot of photographs from when I was growing up, but my kids look at the photographs from like when kids and my brother and my sister, and we're like wearing coats and hats and stuff, and we're in the house. And my youngest said to me one time, wow, you guys must have really played outside a lot, man. You're always wearing your coat and hat. I'm like, dude, that's what we did. There was no heat was down to like 57, save money, 56. And you slept with a lot of blankets. But during the day or something, if you're hanging out in the house, you got the coat on, you got the hat. That's not us playing outside. That's us inside, right? So you grow up like that, right? And then you're like, we got to do better. We got to set ourselves up. We'll go to school. We'll get these loans. We'll hustle. We'll pay off our loans. Bust our ass in our career. And then you still can't put it all together. It's still not all. Like sometimes it does, and you make like strides and things like that. And you hustle. You try to give your kids a better life than you had, right? And then you find out all this stuff's going on that it's kind of stacked. I'm not saying it's completely stacked. You can still pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? But they don't do you any fucking favors. if my mom was still here, I'd say, Mom, it wasn't you. It was rigged. It's stacked. It was stacked against you. We're supposed to be down here in the mud so other people can profit off of us, off of our sweat, off of our tax money, off of our... It's rigged, man. I'd say, Mom, it wasn't you. It wasn't your fault. There's something larger at play. And not that she did anything wrong. She did awesome taking care of... I don't even know how she did it, to tell you the truth. I mean, God, all those long hours. It's crazy, but I wish she was still here so I could explain to her, look, this is like much bigger than just us guys out here in the real world. This is a massive, I say conspiracy. It's a cartel. It's like a criminal conspiracy. I really feel that. And that's how it translates to the regular guys on Main Street, that maybe it's not the moves that you're doing or you're not moving or you're not doing that aren't holding you back. Maybe there are much larger things by design that you are not going to be able to achieve what you have in your mind that you want to achieve. And all the stuff you see on TV and in the movies and in literature that you can pull yourself up and you can be whatever you want. I still think the tenets of that in this country are true. However, they don't tell you about what a minefield it is out here. And that is by design. I'm coming to figure this out, right? I'm 52. It's like, you can't work this fucking hard all the time and not get anywhere. And I'm not the only cat. There's a lot of guys I know in the same ballpark. Sure, they have it a little bit better than their parents, but why is everybody just doing a little bit better? For the most part, there are outliers that are doing great. Hey, that's what it's all about, right? But for the amount, I know a lot of smart people who work their ass off and they don't particularly get anywhere. And then you see these folks in D.C., not the brightest bulbs in the linen closet, and they're millionaires. What? Really? If you debated these folks, you would smoke them. You listen to somebody like Pelosi. Well, it's probably a bad example with her crime family growing up in Baltimore. Her dad was like in the mafia. He was like a mafia don. That's another story. D'Alessandro, former mayor of Baltimore, former House member in Congress, U.S. Congress. We know guys involved with that family. He used to have family reunions, and the relatives and the kids would come in, and he'd sit in a chair, and they'd kiss his ring. This is her dad, okay? So you see, it's like, it's a carry-on of, literally, of an organized crime syndicate, right? So that's probably not a great example of her, but there's not a lot of bright people down there, and they're making a shit ton of money off of our backs and our sweat. And that's what it's all about, apparently. We discussed why I thought Apple was not completely in the wrong by telling the Justice Department that it wasn't going to dance for them by unencrypting these phones, that Barr went on national TV and said, you know, it's the difference between cracking a terrorist ring if Apple doesn't turn over the encrypted data from the two cell phones of the Saudi airman trainee at a Pensacola naval base who gunned down three American soldiers and killed three American soldiers. Suddenly, the guy, the FBI, the DOJ, the State Department, who let this fucking maniac into the country, him and 20 other Saudi Arabian trainees, suddenly it's a pressing case and they're worried about national security and terrorism after the guy guns down three soldiers. Now it's like a full court press. That's what these guys always do. They fuck up, then they chase their tail and they make it everybody else's problem. Anyway, yeah, you can't even believe this story. This is why. This is part of the reason I kind of came out very strong against this Apple shit last week, or this dog and pony show, William Barr, the attorney general, was trying to coerce Apple to give up encrypted data. You can't even believe some of this. The stuff I'm talking about is they want access to all these things, back doors into your VoIP systems, into your telecom, into your mainframes and things, your switches. They want access to that backdoor access so that they can access it without a warrant. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about these guys coming to say, yo, give us access to everything, and so that we don't have to get any warrants and we can spy on people. That's the rub. That's what I'm pissed off about. So we started this telecom company back in 2004, 2005. Was called Star 38. After it was pro, and it was the first company that was, original intent was, there weren't laws at the time, telecom laws, about spoofing your caller ID. So that's what it was. It was a caller ID spoofing company, and I got involved with these guys, and we got it off the ground. Once it was in the New York Times, the feds kind of panicked for obvious reasons. But I got this call from this trade group, and they said, hey, you guys, great profile in the Times. And guys are really arrived on the scene, and we're this telecom trade group, and we want you to come down to, I'll get the trade group in a minute. I have it in my notes somewhere. We want you to come down here to Virginia, and we want to welcome you and probably get you some good contracts, get you off the ground. All you got to do is kind of come down and talk to us, make some introductions. We want to know more about your technology and all this stuff, and congratulations. And I'm like, whoa, this is sweet. That was easy. We just got a couple newspaper articles and an article in the New York Times, and now we're going to get contracts. That's what I'm talking about. So we went down there, but this group, I think it was called ATIS, A-T-I-S. Anyhow, they invite us down there to talk about our technology and our company and help get it off the ground according to them and stuff. So we were like totally psyched. We were like out of money. We put this thing together on a shoestring, like a lot of things. We didn't have any investors, and we very proud of it. And I didn't even think, and it was short notice. They said, hey, can you come down in like a day? We'd like to talk to you. And I'm like, shit, we'll be down here today if it means we're going to get some money out of this deal. And I remember I had this beat up car, and I'm like, I don't even know if we're going to make it down there. So I rented a car. And we went down there right outside the Beltway, and I'm like, this is going to be sweet. Anyhow, so we go into this place, real swanky offices and stuff, and it's a fucking ambush. The feds, it's an ambush. Like you see in the old cowboy movies, where the cowboys ride into the valley and the Indians take their fucking heads off. That's what this was. So this... we come to find out this ATIS is like an organization that works with telecom and law enforcement. And they have all these people, but they basically are the front organization for the FBI's specialist electronic surveillance technology section. And they work with all the major telecom companies, Microsoft, AT&T, Sprint at the time, Sprint Nextel at the time, T-Mobile, and cable companies, which, of course, are responsible for voice over IP, which has become more prevalent even in cell phone conversations. A lot of your cell phone conversations are being carried by VoIP, and you don't even know it. But so these guys were like, it was a complete nightmare. From minute one, you go in, you think you're going to be the man. This is like a trade organization, and you're going to get something fruitful out of it after, you know, you put your ass into building a company. And you're lucky to get out of there without getting locked up. By the time we were done, these guys, they have this, ATIS has a bunch of task force and things. And what they focus on, on behalf of the feds. I don't even know. I think these guys are probably part of the federal government, and they just call themselves like a trade group. Because there was nothing I saw there having anything to do with capitalism or trade. It was more intimidation and you're fucked if you don't give us a backdoor to your voice over IP and your backbone and your technology. They want everything. They wanted everything. And for those listeners who know me, you know probably where this is headed. It turned into like a showdown and it got a little bit ugly because I'm not one to bend over for these assholes and do what they say, because I certainly don't have your best interest in mind at any turn. But so these guys were worried about integrating surveillance capabilities into our technology and how they were going to be able basically to intercept communications sent over VoIP, voice over IP. How were they going to be able to backdoor this to spy on people? And I'll lay the landscape for you real quick. We walk in. It's like, first of all, I knew I was in trouble when the guy who set up the whole meeting, I went in. We went in and he looked like the fucking Shah of Iran or like a poor man, Sammy Davis Jr. And I'm like, it was uncanny. He looked like Sammy Davis Jr. to the point where I was like, I started thinking about Sammy Davis Jr. and the Rat Pack and everything. I was kind of distracted. But he's like very welcoming and he's Middle Eastern. I think he had like an Iranian accent from what I remember, but that's cool. What is this dude from Iran doing working for a telecom trade group? That's so I'm like reading the situation and I know something's like off. Something just feels off. And we walk into this room and there's fucking FBI, DOD, State Department, DEA, Secret Service. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And we sit down at this table and it was like out of a movie. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? And basically the entire meeting was two things. Them trying to get us to explain how the technology worked. Because remember last week I said these guys, they panic. Telecom, they don't really know what the hell's going on. They panic. That was the part. And they had some dunce from the CIA, like a disheveled fool, was writing everything and mapping out everything on a napkin like he was drawing a schematic of the technology. Literally, and he had a host of napkins. This was like, I'm thinking, this guy was like on 3-4 cups of coffee. And I'm thinking, what is this guy doing? Is he trying to like duplicate the technology so they can basically rip us off? That's going through my head. I'm basically against this firing squad of feds. And they're telling me, if you don't build us a back door and give us access to everything we want, you're going to be out of business. We're going to have the FCC shut your ass down. And you're going to be dead on arrival even before you get launched. And I'm thinking, this is insanity. There was one guy there I wanted to just choke out. You know what I mean? Because he's such a snide little prick. And you know that he's probably still a snide little prick fucking up somebody's life in the federal government and just a total nobody trying to push you around and stuff. And I even said to him, yo, Slick, I don't know who the fuck you think you are, who you're talking to, but, you know, you better watch your six, buddy, because I'm not some moron that you can lean on. And that's kind of like how the meeting went. And I basically told them to go fuck themselves. They're not getting a back door to our technology. And all hell broke loose by the time I got back to Philly. You know, there was like cease and desist letters coming from this trade group. And one of the guys I knew from DEA called me and said, man, you're out of line and all this stuff. Like, I'm the fucking problem, right? And I'm saying, no, you guys were out of line. If you want to have me in to talk about the tech, back doors, front doors, side doors, cat doors, fucking dog doors, do it like a man. don't invite me to an ambush and expect me, you know, to sit down. I'm not going to do that. And it was like basically a showdown with these guys. This is how they operate. They don't even have enough balls to tell you to come in to talk about it. There could be problems from a regulatory situation. Okay. Now, we had lawyers and everything that said we were good to go. These guys were trying to pull a strong arm move and say you have to build a back door. This legal, that legal, USC code, blah, 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 blah. You know, because they don't want the technology to be used, quote unquote, by terrorists, which is understandable. But at the same time, that's something that we would be monitoring anyhow. It's not going to be like a web app where people could go crazy. There weren't even apps back then to begin with. There were no apps. So this is how they operate. They're fucking worms and weasels. They invite you to an ambush. Then they use fear and intimidation to try to get what they want. And so that's why I was probably a little bit pissed off more than many folks would be last week, because when Barr goes in front of the microphone and does the same shit that we saw, that I saw at this Fed trade, secret trade group, Shah of Iran, fucking Sammy Davis Jr., Iranian guy, doing a song and dance like the Rat Pack. The only thing missing was this guy doing a tap dance like Sammy Davis is doing in Vegas. You know, and he'd be four or five songs in, and then he'd say, "Hand me my tap shoes, man." And then he'd start, you know, he'd do it, and you're like, "Whoa, this guy's really talented." That was the only thing missing, was these guys, you know, the Shah of Iran doing a fucking tap dance, and the Fed striking up a little orchestra tune. And the funny thing was, is at the end of the meeting, this dope who was scribbling on the napkins in the paper says, "I think I have it all figured out. You know, I think we'd be able, I've figured out how you do it." And I'm like thinking, dude, really? You think you got it all figured out, huh? Okay, good for you. It's like a bad dream. You know what I mean? You're in a room with these people, and they're all out basically to kill you. Economically, you know, they don't like what you're doing. They don't like technology that threatens them. And they don't like the fact that there weren't enough laws at the time to prevent you from doing it. So they'll just try to have you in and intimidate you. I wonder how many. So I since then, I wonder how many people that they intimidate. How many telecom guys they bring in these fucking Poindexters like, "Yeah, well, we'll get that back door built for you as soon as we can. Okay, guys, I love you guys on the CBS. You guys are the fucking best. Can I shake your hand? Maybe get some photos with you guys. You know what I mean?" I mean, and then they build people, they build these people at back doors because they're literally terrified of them. So you might wonder what happened. So I said to these guys, "Fuck you. We're not doing it. No, do something about it." And it was a big showdown. It turned into like a legal, total legal mess, but I wouldn't flinch. And so what we did was kind of a fuck you move is I thought about it for a long time, and it looked like we weren't going to be able to get this thing off the ground. So because of this, and people might say, "Why didn't you just build a back door?" No, not fucking doing it, because I didn't want to and I didn't have to. So I wasn't going to do it. Right. And their contention is if there's a terrorist, that's like their big thing. If there's a terrorist, even when they have information on terrorists, we found they don't do anything. So that excuse is out the fucking window. Time and time again, they shit the bed when it comes to this stuff. They have credible intel from human intel, they have on terrorists in the United States, and they don't do anything until after these people act. We've done many stories on guys who have snapped, killed Americans. And they had intel on these people and did nothing. In fact, many times they cultivate these people. They turn them into information sources. They pay them. And then at some point, they snap, kill people, and then it's like everybody's in cover-up mode, right? I didn't want to build the back door, so we didn't build the back door. That's plain and simple. What I did was I said, okay, so our technology is only for law enforcement now. And they were like, what? I said, it's only for law enforcement because there's tons of law enforcement, right? And they couldn't have a back door because it would compromise other investigations. Like you couldn't have people listening because the investigations are sensitive, classified, etc. So that's what we did. We sold to them. So that was my way of shoving it up their ass. And they didn't get a back door. Not only did you not get a back door, now you got to pay us. Now you got to pay me. You got to pay the company. You got to use the company. And you still don't get what you wanted. So it was kind of like we turned a big negative into a positive, not the direction we wanted to go. But that's the direction we went. And it was successful for a while. I don't know what they're doing with it now. I think eventually it was sold off to them or to somebody in the federal apparatus. I don't really remember. By that time I was out of the picture, but to get it off the ground and initially to run it. So that gives you like a glimpse of how these guys work behind the scenes. They're fucking bullies. They're crazy. When I said last week that they're crazy when it comes to this stuff, that should be a good indication of what I just said. They're literally insane. And I remember one meeting we had. So these guys up in New York wanted to, I think it was FBI or somebody. They're connected to the NFL. That's a whole nother story, right? They're doing security for the NFL, and they had contractors, and they had FBI and the New York Giants and the FBL in New York. And we went up to a meeting. Just a real quick sidebar because it's kind of interesting. We went up to a meeting, and I was with another guy who I trusted and who we'd done some ops before. And I was with my buddy, Dick Callahan, kind of a legend in the Fed circles. He wrote the Fugitive Apprehension Manual for marshals and worked for the agency and a bunch of other people, worked undercover. If you've seen Donnie Brasco, he was the Donnie Brasco of the NYPD, connected to the Justice Department. He just didn't want his name out there, and he didn't want to do a book and all this stuff in a movie because he thought that it would just go against the creative working undercover. So, and he was kind of like my godfather. He definitely was my godfather in the federal apparatus. He got me out of the journalism and brought me into on the federal side, and he was a good friend and a father-like figure to me, and I talk about him in my book, and I detail him in my book, and he brought us up. I brought him into the company. He made a lot of introductions. He knew a lot of people, and he brought us up to this meeting with these guys in New York, and I had another guy with me, like I said, and there were some other guys there in our group that were there as well, but we walk in, and I see this guy, and I meet him. I shake his hand, and I'm saying, I know this fucking guy from somewhere, man. And he starts talking, and he's from North Jersey, and that's where I was working, you know, back when I was rocking and rolling in Hackensack at the record, running their investigative division. And then it hits me, and I think it hits this guy soon afterwards. I'm like, oh, shit, I put this fucking guy in jail. He worked for the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office. He was like a top cop up there. And I said, oh, man, I put this fucking guy in jail. And if he makes me, we not only lose this contract, but I might not make it out of the room without getting some kind of a dust up. So I say to the guy I'm with, I need to step outside the room for a minute here. And I said I had a call, you know, and I told the guy I was with to come out. I said, hey, can you come out here for a minute? And I told him what was going on. He said, all right, the guy got an idea. So he went out to the car and he came back in. He said, I got a cell jammer. So if this guy makes you, we're just going to jam everybody's cell in the room. So that if he makes you and picks up the phone to call a buddy, because what happened was he got locked up with a buddy. They lost their job and everything together. And I'm thinking he's going to call this other fucking guy, or he's going to call his lawyer, who I knew, and say, hey, you know, what was the guy's name who wrote for the Record that got us in trouble? So lo and behold, like 20 minutes later, I think the guy makes me, right? And he's reaching for his phone and he's dialing his phone. He's not having any luck. But we got the cell jammer going. So nobody in the room can get calls or make calls. It was really a thing of beauty, really, to have, you know, because you never know what you're going to face. So you have to be kind of ready for those things. But and we got outside of the room and I said, and Dick was like having small talk with the one guy who ran the Giants, former FBI guy who ran the Giants security. And I said, yeah, Dick, we got a call. Like, we got to go. It was like a fucking 911 call. I said, we got to roll. And he's like, calm down. I said, Dick, we got to roll. You know what I mean? Because the cell jammer, it works in a small place, right? But when the doors open and people are walking around, you can't jam a whole zip code. So I said, we got to get out of here. And we got in the car. I said, I fucking locked that guy up. I know he made me. And we got to get out of here because I think like the guy's probably going to want to fight me. So it comes out like 2 or 3 days later, Dick calls me and said, that fucking guy wants to kill you. He literally wanted to kill you. He figured it out afterwards. And, you know, he called everybody up and that was involved and he found... Oh, man, you can't even make this stuff up. But, you know, back in the day, I dismantled that entire prosecutor's office when I was coming up and learning the ropes. I tore that place to shreds. I had some help, too. I had a good partner on some of the stories. But most of it was driven by myself, to be honest with you. And we tore that. When I say we, I mean the Record tore that place to shreds. And unfortunately, the main prosecutor that we forced out committed suicide recently, and it's kind of unfortunate, but you don't ever wish that on anybody. But there was a lot of corruption there, so and I've said it before, I've used the motto I used when I was in my 20s to pick that place apart. Same motto I've used for the FBI, and it works. It's like a gradual 1,000 paper cut model. You know, death by 1,000 paper cuts, so to speak. And that's how you literally dismantle a corrupt organization. So some interesting stories there, for sure. And I'm not the only one who's had problems running a telecom company with the federal government, problems with the federal government. Former Quest CEO Joe Nachio ended up in prison because he wouldn't play games with the NSA and the DOJ. They cooked up some rap for insider trading or something. Joe Nachio, let me Google this real quick. Joe Nachio, there he is. Hold on. Let's see if we can find this guy, John. Yeah, take the name Nachio. Let's see if you can break your record over there. Try to dig this guy up, find out where he's at. Yeah, we'll see. We used to challenge each other back at Intel if you could, you know, how fast you could find somebody and get phone numbers and stuff like that. And it all started once we were working an op in New York City and some guy in a livery, a town car, a limo driver cut us off. And I remember his license plate. He was hanging out the window at a stoplight. He did something. I blew the horn at him. We were in a government car and I blew the horn at him and the guy pulled up. He's like, hey, you, what are you doing, tough guy? You think you're a tough guy, huh? You want to blow the horn? I'm like, oh, here we go. So we just rolled the window up. We had like this tinted pimp ride, G-rod, and just rolled the window up and I said, all right. How fast you think we could get this guy? Let's tail him. How fast you think we could get his phone, his cell phone? And we all put a little bit of money in a pot. And I the over-under was like 25 blocks. Well, maybe it was 35 blocks or 25 blocks. And I think we had his cell phone number in maybe 20 blocks or something. I think definitely reached the under because I got paid on it. And then I called the guy on his cell phone. I was like, hey. He's like, hello? I was like, hey, tough guy, who's the tough guy now, huh? Who's the tough guy? And the guy's like, what? I said, yeah, you were just threatening us about 15 minutes ago at the stoplight. Huh, tough guy? Are you going to be the tough guy or are you going to drive normal? Because you never know who you're messing with when you hang out a window like a fool. You don't know who you're messing with. So why don't you just settle down? Because we know who you are, but you don't know who we are. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, let's see if we can get Nacho's information and maybe try to scare him up and get his opinion on some of this telecom stuff we've been talking about. I'm just looking over this real quick to get some background. Quest, NSA. Yeah, I read about this guy's case before, and it definitely mirrors what I'm talking about, although they took it to the wall with this guy. They really put him through the ringer. So we can track this guy down. You have any luck with that? Well, it's been like 5 minutes. You got it? Get out of here. Let me see. Really? Huh. All right. That, what do you mean next week? Why would we do it next week? Got the phone number supposedly for Nacho and Joe Nacho, Quest CEO, and saying, yeah, we'll do it next week. We'll call the guy for next week's podcast. Why wait till next week? Let's fucking call him now. What are we, fucking 60 minutes? We got to call the guy and set up. Usually it's like, usually how these interviews work, you have a producer call the target and say, oh, yeah, Thomas Paine would like to speak with you. And, you know, let's set up a time and we can talk about it. This is what he would like to talk to you about. And what's your availability, right? That's like mainstream media. This is True Pundit Thomas Paine podcast. It's like, oh, you got his number? Okay, let's fucking call the guy. What? Wait till next week. Why not this week, right? I'm here talking about, oh, we have to do stuff and time is of the essence. Why would I wait a week? Let's fucking call the guy. Let me see. Try to call this guy. All right, let me dial him here. Hold on. See how this crazy thing works here. This is part of the fun, right? I don't know what the hell I'm doing half the time. So you're on this crazy journey with me. Whoa. That's insane. Let's see here. Keypad. Let's see. Let's turn that down. Let's see. All right, here we go. I'll keep this off, like, down in case, you know, doesn't want to talk or something. Hey, how you doing? I'm looking for Joe Nacho. Yeah, my name's Mike Moore from True Pundit. All right. I think that was his wife or something. I'm getting he's coming on the phone. Hold on. This could be good. I'm going to have to fall back on some of my instincts and wing it here a little bit. But if he went through the system and I went through the system. Hey, Joe. Hey, hold on for a sec. How does this stupid thing work? Hold on. Joe, hold the wire for a second. I'm trying to get this thing to work. Joe, you there? Question for you. I'm my name is Mike Moore. I'm a reporter. And okay. I work on telecom issues. You got a minute?
Sure. It's been a long time since anybody asked me any questions about telecom. Well, go ahead, Mike.
I'm not a regular guy. Well, I used to own my own telecom company, and I was kind of... Anyway, I was looking at your case and reading about it and stuff, and... It was very intriguing.
You're talking about that the criminal case back 15 years ago.
Yeah, not so much the criminal case. I mean, I know what these guys do and how they operate. I mean, just more or less that I was trying to look at really what happened behind the criminal case, because
right.
I think that gets glossed over.
Right, it is.
At least I'm trying to read between the lines, but it's hard because, you know, without talking to you and these reporters, the stuff the clips that I read, I'm like, something's missing. There's like a puzzle piece or two that doesn't really make sense. So,
Mike, you said you're a reporter now.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And who do you work for and who do you report for?
I have my own place called True Pundit.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So is it kind of like a blog or what is it?
Well, it started out as a blog, but it's gotten pretty big. So I guess it's just, okay. I don't know what I call it. But I also do started a podcast, and I might use this for a podcast or something too. It depends on which way it goes, to be honest with you. But because
sure. Let me help you.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Joe.
No, just say, go ahead. Tell me what you'd like to know. I'll tell you as much as I can.
Well, my own experience was, we started this VoIP company, Voice over IP, and it was set to launch. It was a story in the New York Times, and then the feds brought us in, some trade group in Virginia said, hey, come down and talk to us. And we went down there, and I thought, wow, this is going to be easy. We really made it. But it was like an ambush. All these feds were there, and they were like, hey, man, you can't launch without giving us access to all this. And I'm like, F you, we're not giving you access to anything. So, and then I see that, and then I read your case, and I'm thinking, what happened with this guy? What happened with Nacho?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I called you.
Yeah, well, what's been reported, such a complicated issue. I was prosecuted under securities fraud law, which had nothing to do about the case, but was a front for what was going on.
Right, they're famous for that.
Yeah, I spent, I think it was 17 months prior to trial, fighting evidentiary issues in a secret court called a court authorized under the Classified Information Procedure Act called the SEPA court. And in a SEPA court, essentially, the judge and the prosecutors can do almost anything they want. In other words, because everything's classified, a lot of your due process rights, a lot of what are considered normal federal rules of evidence issues in a criminal trial get discarded.
Right. It's not admissible in the criminal trial.
Yeah. Well, it's not only not admissible, you might pass the standard for admissibility in a normal criminal trial, but because it's classified, they can keep it out. And that's essentially what I went through. And look, this whole thing emanates from a meeting on February 27th, 2001, 7 months prior to 9/11, where I, as the CEO of Quest, and some of my people, we were involved with obviously classified work, were invited to a meeting at Fort Meade, and I went as I was supposed to, and I was in a skiff and got briefed on what the purpose of the meeting was, and we met with the senior folks at the NSA. Now, what's his name was supposed to be there, the three-star who ran NSA at the time,
right.
The Bush later had become the head of the CIA, and he didn't show, and that should have been a warning sign, but there were other senior people. And we had the legitimate meeting that we were supposed to have. And then at the end of that, there were some folks around the table on the other side who asked us to participate in another operation. And I had been around the block a few times, so I understood the obligations, running a public telecom under both the 96 Communication Act and then the 86 Privacy Act on electronic information. And I said, we'd be happy to comply if you have a FISA warrant. And they said FISA warrant wasn't necessary. That made my antennae go up a little. And then I said, do you have a letter? Do you have executive authority from the president to the NSC? Because the NSA reports to the NSC. I dotted line in terms of my position as the head of the National Security Telecommunication Advisory Committee into the NSC. And
They said no, it wasn't required. And I basically said, it might not be required for you. It's required for me. I'm running a public company. I said, look, we'll be happy to work with you guys. You got to show us some legal justification. It never came. They came back to my people 4 or 5 times, insistent that we participate. They said, Quest didn't participate. Essentially what they were trying to do, they couldn't get done. You know, because remember, this is the world prior to everybody going for an IP architecture. So you have really three networks, three architectures out there. You have the beginning of what's the standard IP protocols now.
Right.
And so you have network access points from traditional telephone long distance networks into that. And then you had, the whole class 5 issue of local switches. And remember, we owned US West at the time. So the bottom line is, without us participating, they really couldn't accomplish what they wanted. And I kept asking for legal justification. They never proposed it, and we never participated.
You're saying that it was NSA that kept coming back?
Well, let me simply say, because again, even that is classified.
I know who it is, yeah. But I mean, if we're going to play this like on the radio or something, I'm just trying to explain it to people.
Yes. No, what is public information is that the meeting was held at Fort Meade, the NSA headquarters.
Right.
Now, one of the you might may or may not know is very few of these really deep intelligence operations are a single agency operation, because what you do is you combine the capabilities of different ones, and you almost have a team that gets formed around what they're trying to accomplish.
Exactly.
So anyhow, we said no. This happened at a time. This is February 2001, February 27th to be specific. In October of 2000, at my annual shareowner meeting in New York City, Manor Analyst Meeting, where we had maybe 1,000 people at the Waldorf, I announced that I was entering what's called the 10b5-1 program at the SEC, where you set up a blind trading program for your options. You know, you started in an open window. The lawyers designed the plan to comply with the SEC rules, and I announced that I was going to start that in the January window.
And you're talking about your private stocks, your private options? Is that what you're talking about?
These would have been stock options,
right,
that I was granted at the Quest. And I explained to the audience that the problem and the reason I was doing it is that the original stock options offered me in 1997 were 5-year options, not the standard 10. And I had to either use them or lose them. And so I had gone to the board. I had asked for them to extend the options from 5 to 10. There was an accounting charge. I think it was about $320 million if they did that. They chose not to do it. They asked me to get on this program. So to make a long story short, I start this 10b5-1 program in that January. This meeting happens in February. I terminate the program in May of that year, 2001. And then in June of 2001, at a meeting in the executive office building next to the White House, Dick Clark, who's on the NSC staff, and notifies me, and I'm surprised he told me this outside of the SCIF, that certain contracts that we thought we had or were having about to implement were going to another place. And I challenged Dick about where they were putting it, because on his argument, it was for diversity purpose. I told him that was a bogus argument, because the people that they were rendering the contracts to were riding my backbone. So I said, that's bullshit. That couldn't be what it was. Well, what it really was, which came out years later, was retaliation for not participating. But as a result of that, and then, of course, 9/11 happened in September, as a result, and, you know, business activity around the country slows down. But as a result of all of that, they bring a case against me that I was misleading the public on my 2001 projections. And by the way, so that's how it all starts. So in my defense, which is what I'm trying to bring out, is, remember that to be convicted criminally, you have to have the intent to do wrong. Mens rea is the legal concept. And I was trying to bring out, look, here's what I knew, here's when I knew it, here's what I believed, here's how the numbers were set up. okay? And not everyone in the firm knew this stuff. I knew it. Some people who have the classified coverage knew it. But that factors into my thinking of what's a reasonable public guidance. I wasn't allowed to bring any of that into the trial. So I refused to take the stand in my defense because, you know, if I can't defend myself, I can't defend myself. I wasn't going to be part of the Star Chamber operation. And you know, history proved that they should convict anybody they want to.
Well, once it gets to that stage, Joe, you know, you're at the judge's mercy on sentencing day, you know, because these guys can and they get whatever they want at that stage, and it's a very humbling experience.
I can't prove it, but I believe the intelligence agencies essentially monitor everything that these judges do and have shit on every judge, which is why the judges never deny a FISA warrant. You saw this big controversy that's broken out now over the Trump issue with the FISA warrants. I personally believe I personally believe there's an administrative state that doesn't give two shits about the law or about who's elected. You know, they do what they think they want to do. There is a deep state. Look, my federal judge in the FIPA courts were ruling in our favor on a lot of important evidentiary issues. And then in one session, which is, again, this is all classified. And by the way, some of these classified things have been let out to the press in a redacted form because they're challenged by the Denver Post. We had a guy show up.
This is federal court in Colorado, am I right?
Yeah. Federal court in Colorado. The guy, the judge was a guy named Nottingham, Edward Nottingham III. He was briefed and allowed to run the CIPA court. Nottingham, in one session, you know, usually these are all private sessions or I say in camera, classified sessions. The public's not have access to it. His transcripts are not public. Defense lawyers are in there, plus the prosecutors, you know, I'm in there. And all of a sudden, we get these guys who come out of DOJ to want to talk to the judge. And one of the guys' names is a guy named Simkins, S-I-M-K-I-N-S. And his title was the Assistant Attorney General for Counterterrorism. Okay? Now, what the hell, if this is an insider trading case and there's no classified information that's relevant, why does the Assistant Attorney General for Counterterrorism, a guy named Simpkins, and in the non-redacted transcript, his name shows up, by the way, in the redacted transcript, his name shows up, it's redacted, he shows up, and then he and the DOJ ask for something that is not allowed in criminal trials, but again, it's allowed in CIPA courts. They ask for a private, what's called an in-camera, ex parte communication with the judge. That is never allowed in criminal trials. One side cannot talk to the judge without the other side knowing it.
Okay, well, you're saying they asked for that, but your counsel wasn't allowed in?
We get asked to leave the room.
What the hell is it?
We get asked to leave the secret courtroom, and somebody from DOJ, counterterrorism, the chief assistant attorney general, counterterrorism, Brandon Simpkins, has a private conversation with this judge. And then from that point on, the judge overrules, well, I wouldn't say overrules, he goes back on some of the previous decisions that were in our favor and reverses them so that nothing's evidentiary. Now here's what's really interesting.
Real quick, okay. Did your lawyer object to that and say, what's going on?
Of course we did. Yeah. Of course we did. But guess what? It's all classified. Nobody gets to see it. And you have no legal rights, okay? Because you're in a classified court.
Well, just real quick, they lock everything down in classified court, and then they say, well, yeah, you worked for the government, and this is national security, so you can't even use this evidence in your criminal trial.
Correct. Matter of fact, one of the reasons my lawyers didn't want to put me on the stand was they knew that if I was on the stand, you know, I always, the argument that you cannot ring the bell. You know, I'll say what I want to say in front of a jury. But then, of course, what would have happened is I could have been acquitted there and they would have filed a superseding indictment saying I violated the Espionage Act. Like they did with those
and
guys.
You're better off taking your lumps with whatever they're charging you with. As opposed to espionage.
Yeah. So my lawyers refused to put me on the stand. And, you know.
Well, that was smart, way, though. I mean, you might not have recognized it at the time, but I mean, it's like they got way or the other. But if they come after you for espionage, it's 25 plus years.
But, yeah, so basically, I got convicted for not committing a crime, and the lawyers prevented me from committing a crime, right? So that's what really happened there.
Well, you went away for how long? How long were you in prison for?
I was sentenced to 72 months on appeal. It got reduced to 70 months.
But you served. You didn't have to serve the whole 70, did you?
Well, in the federal system, you get 14.6% of your time reduced for good time.
Right.
So I served about 5 years in total.
Jeez. You're in Pennsylvania now, where I'm at, I think.
I did it. I spent time in Schuylkill, which is a... of course, I was a low security risk, so I was in prison camp, except for 8 weeks, 7 weeks, when I had to go back to court in Denver, where the marshals sent me to five maximum security prisons, where I stayed in regular cell blocks. I was in solitary for my own protection, quote unquote, in Oklahoma City. I had four flights on Con Air for a 15-minute court appearance, where I waived my right to appear. And had to have my lawyers represented me, but the judge said, in order for you to waive your right to appear, you have to appear. That's how absurd it was.
So what you're telling me is, I'm reading between the lines here, is that even when you were locked up, they were still harassing you.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me tell you, I'm going to give you two terms that people don't know about. One term is, if you're a federal inmate, some of us are designated as CIM, C-I-M, inmates. And that means centralized inmate management. That means you are a high-profile conviction, and there are people in Washington who are monitoring your stay. Monitoring is a polite word. The second thing I would tell you is, this is a word that the inmates use. It's called diesel therapy. Diesel therapy. Diesel therapy is when they want to give you the treatment, as they did me, where instead of giving me a furlough to travel to court, which I offered to pay U.S. Marshals, you know, the cost is necessary. A warden can do that. They can let you go to court. You could be escorted by U.S. Marshals, which would have taken 1 day to get to Denver, 15 minutes in court, and 1 day back. Instead, they refused that, and I had to travel with the U.S. Marshal Service to do 15 minutes in Florida. I'm sorry, do 15 minutes in Denver. I traveled for 7 weeks. I was locked solitary. I was in four other maximum security penitentiaries.
Has any reporter ever asked you about this stuff, or you've been harboring this up?
You know, it's really interesting. I've got a book coming out which details all of this.
Nice.
And my prison experience. And you know, I like to say, I'm one of the, you know, remember, this all happened because of something in 2001, prior to 9/11. So I'm one of the first victims of the deep state as it started to be uncovered, you know, 13, 14, 15 years later by the Trump administration.
What's the name of the book you got coming out, Joe?
The name of the book is going to be called Freedom Fall, F-A-L-L, Freedom Fall. The subtitle will be The Price of Conscience in a World of Universal Surveillance.
Yeah, that's something that I personally want to pick up and read, because I've had some experience. You know, you grew up where in New York? What part of New York?
All five boroughs of New York City. I was born in Brooklyn.
You're an Italian guy, right? Nacho, that's Italian.
Yeah, born in Brooklyn, raised in Staten Island prior to the Garzano Bridge going up.
Right.
Went to high school in Manhattan, went to Stuyvesant, went to engineering school at NYU when it was up in the Bronx, through a mistake with some friends. I lived in Queens a while, then moved back to Manhattan. So I've lived in all five boroughs. I tell people my accent is a totally cosmopolitan accent. It has all five boroughs of New York in it.
Well, did your grandparents come over, or they were over, or your parents came? How did it go? Or your lineage goes further back?
Three out of four of my grandparents came to America between 1885 and 1897, I believe. My one grandparent, on my mother's side, her mother was born in 1898 here, but her parents had come over earlier.
Are you Italian on both sides?
100%.
All right,
yeah,
so
100%.
The reason I'm asking this, right, is because, I don't know, it's like an old school vibe, I think, with dudes that that grew up in the neighborhood, so to speak. And, you know, becoming a rat isn't like something that is looked upon very well. So, for me personally, I kind of carry that around. Like, I'm not a rat. And I think it's like, I think it's something that's like, branded. It's like from your family, you know, you don't rat, do what's right.
But on the second point is the correct one. There was never a situation for me to be a rat, because for me to tell what happened, I would have had to break a law. I got in trouble for refusing to break a law.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about that, Joe. I don't want to cut you up, but the fact that they're asking for you to basically rubber stamp or bypass FISA laws as the director of a CEO of a major telecom. It's like, yo, that's not the way things work. And then when you stand up and you try to do the right thing, like maybe I didn't frame it right saying rat, but I think it all goes together. You try to do the right thing, you know.
Well,
and
that's the right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were brought up to do the right thing. And, you know, it was just ingrained in me to do the right thing. I never imagined that doing the right thing and asking for right legal documentation to do something like this would result in anything like what happened. And, you know, it was a very unpleasant part of my life. I paid my dues because I had no choice. And, you know, I've moved on from that, so to speak.
When you sat down and have you finished the book? Is it done?
Well, the book is done. My literary agent has it. He's marketing it right now. Look, personally, I'm biased because I wrote it, and then I got a professional editor to help me write it even better. It's a very entertaining book. You know, it talks about the advice I got was, let's make all the points you want to make about surveillance, the overcriminalization of America, the abuses by the Department of Justice and the intelligence agencies. Let's not write a book that just says that. Let's tell your story, okay? And as we tell the story, these points will come out. Now, there's a summary chapter where, having gone through this, I make a set of recommendations, you know. And to be perfectly honest with you, if my literary agent doesn't have a contract for me in the next month, I'm going to go self-publish it just to get it out there.
Yeah, I mean, I self-published my book last year, and the thing has done very well, and I got tired of waiting for...
Yeah, did you go through Amazon, or who did you use for self-publishing?
Yeah, we went through Amazon, and I had these people give me a song and dance. This is going to be great. This is going to be great. But it's like an anti-FBI slant, because I left journalism when I was up in Jersey. I left journalism. And I went into Intel, and I started asking too many questions about certain things. And the next thing you know, they're coming and kicking my door and stuff, and my family, and pointing guns at my kids and stuff. So I said, and then I got charged with some bullshit charge. And I said, after it was all over, when I was on probation, you know, my wife was looking at me like, I mean, God love her, you know, she stood by my side, but she's kind of like, are you gonna let them get away with this? And I'm like, no, fuck them. I'm not going to let them get away. I'm going to go back into journalism, and I'm going to become a big pain in the ass to them. So that's kind of like my story. But I mean, so I probably can empathize with you more than anybody else, because I've been through the system too. Not as bad as you. I mean, they sent you through the ringer, but I was a judge's decision. You know, you and I could have been cellmates for all I know. What the hell do I know? I mean, it's all up to the judge when it gets to that point. It's like it's a roll of the dice.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The judge who handled my case, let me tell you a couple of interesting facts, too. First of all, I was charged with a novel concept of insider trading. Usually insider trading is You have knowledge of something that happened. You don't report it. You do your trading. Then the news comes out and your stock price falls, right? What they were accusing me of, and I'm the only case in America where this has been the charge, that my projections about the future 18 months in advance were false. Now, my conviction gets overturned by the appellate court in the 10th Circuit. Okay? You know, you always go before a three-judge panel.
Right.
It gets overturned on a 2-1 vote. The Department of Justice comes in, and they ask for what's called an en banc review. That means they want the full 12 judges to review the decision of the three judges, right?
Yeah, they do that as kind of like, oh, okay, you won this round, but now we're going to bring in all the other rig guys and sell you down the river.
Well, let me tell you how Rig did it. Okay, three judges recused themselves, including Gorsuch, who's now on the Supreme Court, and my conviction gets reinstated on a 5-4 vote. We then appeal to the Supreme Court, which is an extraordinary long shot, right? When the Supreme Court is considering which cases to take, they usually vote up or down at one session. My case, the writ of, it's called the writ of certiorari, gets to the Supreme Court, and they look at it in early June. They don't decide to accept it, and they don't decide to reject it. Very unusual. They inform us and the DOJ that they're taking my case and they're going to take it outside of their process, and over the summer they're going to read the entire trial transcript and decide if they're going to handle it. Come that September, they decide not to handle it. Now, here's what I believe.
That's what they call slow walking something on behalf of the Justice Department.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you one more on behalf of the Intelligence Agency. My judge in my criminal trial, right after I get convicted, gets caught up in a prostitution scandal in Denver. And he gets caught by FBI, okay, who are interviewing, they do the interviewing for the 10th Circuit or any circuit if you've got a problem with a judge. They interview some of these prostitutes who tell the FBI that the judge coached them on how to answer questions. That's called obstruction of justice and witness tampering, right?
Absolutely.
The judge does not get charged by the U.S. attorney out there, the same one who charged me, okay, and is allowed to resign from the federal bench, okay, and doesn't lose his law license by the Colorado Bar Association.
And he gets to keep his pension, too.
No, he lost his pension.
He should have been locked up.
He should have been locked up. Now, interestingly, if I close the loop, let me tell you what I think happened when that guy from counterterrorism, Timkins, talked to the judge, which got him to reverse everything. Of course, you can't prove any of this because it's all classified and they don't even record it. If you remember when Elliot Spitzer
Real quick, that when you go into that court and, well, especially if he's going into the chambers in some kind of rigged in-camera situation, there's no stenographer. You don't know what the hell was said.
Exactly. Here's what I think was said. I think the intelligence agencies, who I know monitor the courts, okay, and who I think influenced the 10th Circuit on that 5-4 vote, okay, I think they said to the judge, this is my language, not theirs, hey, judge, let me tell you what we know about you, okay? We want this guy convicted. We want none of this shit into the trial record. And then after it all happened, it broke anyhow. And then they protected him from getting disbarred and sent to prison.
Yeah, you're talking about something I've been talking about for a while. I call it a protection racket. This is a protection racket. They got the stuff on the guy, and when they want to when they want to turn the screws on him, you're the guy left holding the bag.
Okay, what my book talks about is the danger of what this means to the average citizen in America now. My case being illustrative.
Look, yeah, but real quick, you were a CEO of a major telecommunications company, right? And you had at least some wherewithal to defend yourself, some money, but the regular guy doesn't have that kind of money.
That's why 98% of federal indictments by the DOJ end up in a plea bargain. Only 2% go to trial. Of the 2% that go to trial, DOJ wins 98% of those. when they lose it, as they did in mine at the trial level on appeal, less than 1% of the time do they ever ask for an en banc review. They did in my case. Okay. Now, the final fact is, in 2007, after I'd been convicted, President Bush tried to get a renewal of the Patriot Act, all right? And this trial transcript, according to my on my trial, was finally released in a redacted transcript form. Okay, the day after it was released, the Rocky Mountain News had a front page story that basically says, I'm paraphrasing, hey, Nascio was correct that there were classified information that was relevant to his trial. The day after that, that was Thursday, on a Friday, Washington Post had a front page story that said, Bush administration has been lying. They were spying on Americans prior to 9/11. The Patriot Act gets held up, and then Bush requires that the retroactive immunity be granted to all telecom companies, okay, back to 9/11. Okay, first time in American history. It's called ex post facto. It never happened. He does it. Guess who's excluded from that?
You.
Me.
Yeah, because
Congress passes it. So let me tell you something. There's a deep state. They're running it. You get on their bad side, you're going to get screwed one way or another. I'm still going to put the book out. But that's why I've been pretty much low profile for the last 10 years.
No, I mean, I wanted to look you up. I said, I got to find this guy. He's like, you're tucked away. I'm not going to say where, but, and I said, well, you know, he's been through a couple of folks here said, maybe, you know, you shouldn't look. I said, now this guy's been through the ringer. I'll find him. I'll talk to him. I'll get him to talk because, you know,
you got my wife's cell phone. You didn't even get mine.
I mean, we have our ways.
The thing that's interesting is my wife has always used her maiden name and, you know, doesn't go by my last name.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, Joe. When I come looking for you, I mean, you know, I used to work for these guys, so I know all the tricks. I taught these guys some tricks too. But I mean, here's the thing, right? And I appreciate you talking to me. I think your story is spot on. It's like I can see this. I read through the lines of these court cases and stuff, and some of these reporters are dopes. And I say to myself, there's something missing here. Like, this guy was muscled, and then they come up with this insider trading scheme and things like that. But going back to, like, you're from New York, and I'm just curious how your feeling of what this country is has changed.
Listen. I like to joke that the largest organized crime family in America is the Department of Justice. I have no respect for our system of government and laws. I think the elite, whether it's the rich political elite, or whether it's the governmental elite, you know, those GS-12s and 30, whatever the highest members are, that are always there, irrespective of the president and the politicians, the swamp, so to speak, I think it's totally corrupt. All right, look, I'm being extreme. I say totally corrupt. Everybody is corrupt. But what they teach us about how great our system is versus how it really works, that's propaganda for the masses. And I think it has to get reformed. I think there's a lot of things to do to reform it. It will never get reformed because people in power don't like to give up power. And here's the point I was trying to make earlier, which I just belabored for a minute. What you have now that you didn't have 30 years ago, 35 years ago when we were growing up, is you have technology now that can allow them to surveil everybody in this country all the time, okay? Number one. Number two, when this republic was formed, there were 12 federal crimes, piracy, sedition. There's only 12. You've got now, on the federal side, 4,800 crimes that'll put you in prison, and you've got 200,000 administrative rules that are given to the executive branch, the agencies, that can result in jail time. That's at the federal side. And that only represents 12% or 20% of the total amount of people who go away. So think about this. You got universal surveillance. You have this over-criminalization of America where everybody's breaking the law every day, and the government can get information on anybody, okay? And when they decide you're a problem, you're cooked. That, to me, would make George Orwell turn over in his grave. It would make Stalin and Hitler envious that they were born a century too early. Okay?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
That's what's going on.
Let's just take something that I would want to know, talking to you now that I got you on the phone. If you could go back to 2001, the meeting with the NSA and stuff, and you've been through the ringer, through the federal system, basically harassed in many different turns and imprisoned and everything. Like people, I don't think, a little sidebar, I don't think people realize this isn't like TV. When you go through the system and stuff, at least for me, it's not like TV, everything's wrapped up in a fucking hour.
Yeah.
Like, you can't sleep. You don't know what's right. going on. Your wife is like, she wants to stand by you, and then you feel bad because you have to internalize what she's going through and all the ways.
Right.
You know, you got kids, you got finances, you got everything, and you don't know how long you're going away for, and you don't know if something's going to happen to your family while you're away, and then
right.
you have to carry that. It's like a massive boulder on your head.
It disrupts the entire rest of your life.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, if you, knowing that and everything you had to go through, if you had a time machine and you went back and they said, hey, Nacho, give us the information, give us the surveillance without these FISA warrants, you know, would you do anything different?
Well, I think what I might have done different, and I've thought about that a lot, and let me answer your question by telling you something related to your question. I have consulted with maybe a dozen, two dozen white-collar guys who are facing time. And every one of them, I say to them, take the best plea deal you can. Do not fight this system.
Yeah, you're not going to win. You can't win. Stacked.
So I think, in retrospect, oh, by the way, besides the jail time, I was fined $19 million. And I had to give restitution of $62 million back on top of it all, too. So it was a big deal. But here's the bottom line. If I had to go back in time, it's a tough call. I probably, in order to save, you know, the hardship on the family and everyone, and knowing nobody really cares, okay, because no reform has ever occurred, I would probably have said to them, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you work with Mr. So-and-so over here? And, you know, we'll figure something out. And what left the meeting and not giving them an answer. And then found a way to critique my fingerprints off the thing completely.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know what, that's funny. That's kind of my contention. They I said this to so many people. They don't understand when you're working for these guys or with these guys. They press you at every, like, turn. And they'll take somebody who maybe is not, quote-unquote, corruptible, and you're just like, man, these guys are so crazy and unpredictable. I better just play ball. And it's like a whole nother personal trauma. At least it was for me. I don't know.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot more in my story, a lot more experiences I was worried about. But I won't bore you with that because, you know, I know that let me tell you one interesting story as a vignette. I'm in a meeting at the White House in a Situation Room. In that meeting, it's Condoleezza Rice at the head of the table, myself, Dick Clark, General Radke, who was four-star general, had what's called the high ground, Space Command, the Air Force, Cheyenne Mountain, all that stuff. A guy named General Radke, who was the guy who had all the information assistance for the Defense Intelligence Agencies. A couple of other CEOs, mostly from defense contractors, senior guy from Microsoft, you know, all the people who are involved in these kind of things. I remember, I'm the fiber optics guy. As we're walking out of the meeting, I'm walking with Dick Clark, and you walk at the White House, you go to that little guard shack in the front as you're coming off the property. Clark says to me, Joe, where's your security? And I said, Dick, I don't travel with security. And he says, what are you, crazy? He says, you're a high-profile CEO, and you're working with us. I said, well, yeah, but Dick, you know, I don't think anything. I mean, he says, Joe, you don't understand something. He says, you know how easy it is to kill somebody. He says, killing somebody is pretty easy. 200-yard headshot, it happened anytime you want it to happen. The trick is to make it look like a suicide.
He's telling you this, you're inside the White House when he says this to you?
As we're walking out down the White House lawn. And then he says to me, which is really funny, he says, he says, Joe, he writes the phone number in the back of his card. He says, give this number to your wife. If you ever get kidnapped, tell her, don't call the local police and the FBI. Call us. We can't get you back. Nobody can.
You think that was like an intimidation play, or those just like...
No. This is when we were all, working together.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. It could go either way, depending on the mood of the meeting.
No, this is no intimidation. This is, I can't believe you're traveling around without security. And, you know, you're working with us. You're a high-profile CEO. You know how risky this is. You get, here's your number. If you ever have it to you, have a call us. We'll take care of it. If we can't get you back, nobody can.
Yeah, but then the ironic thing is, Joe, you find out that the only gangsters you had to worry about were the guys you were working for.
Exactly.
It's crazy, man. It's
And by the way, this all begins. It's in my book. It all begins, but 6 months after I take Quest public, I'm sitting in my office in Colorado in October of 1997, and I'm between meetings, getting ready for the next meeting. One of my guys comes in and says, "Hey, Joe, there's a 3-star general down in the lobby who wants to meet you." Now, I thought they were kind of coming after me because I had a high lottery number during the Vietnam War and didn't have to go. I figured, what the hell does a 3-star general want to talk to me for? And this guy walks in with a kind of a first lieutenant in the Air Force and a civilian who was introduced to me as a consultant. I later learned he was a member of one of the intelligence agencies. And the long and short of it is, he came into me and he said, "Mr. Nascio, we've been observing, your IPO and the kind of technology you're using and what you say about it. We'd like to talk to you more, but we really can't say much more right now because, we'd have to get you a clearance." So I reminded him, I said, I had a clearance when I was at AT&T. He said, "Oh, we'd have to renew it." So I go through the whole test of getting a clearance, lie detector test and all that stuff. And as a result of that, one of our earliest contracts is one of the biggest contracts we ever had. Now, I didn't even solicit that. They came to me, being a naive kid growing up in New York City, the government comes to you, the 3-star general, and he wants your help, and he's going to give you a top secret security clearance, and you're going to be read into programs with a need to know. You don't say no, right?
You don't say no because you think that you're, at that point, you think you're helping.
I actually think I'm helping the country, I'll tell you now, I wouldn't tell you the things I'd be prepared to do if I had to, but I have no respect, have zero respect for politicians. I think the lawyers in the DOJ is the largest criminal organization in this country. I think the intelligence community spies on all of us all the time, including probably this conversation.
They can listen in because I'm going to play the fucking conversation anyhow, and they can stick it right up their ass.
I've said it all before, as they say in that song. It's just the way it is. Going to get this book out, hopefully, and, maybe we'll have an impact. And if I can help you with your story, that would be great.
It's good stuff. I'm going to do a podcast on this, I think, and
let me know about.
And I'll keep you in the loop, but I also want to know about when the book comes out, and we can do this again and get further into some details, because we're like kindred spirits, man. I apologize, but I'm Irish.
that's okay. Italians and Irish really did hang out together in New York City.
Amen. Amen.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it. I think that we need more people waking up to find that the stuff that they see on the regular television news and even on Fox, it's like, it's fantasy land. It's nothing to do with anything. It's complete fantasy. Right. It's complete fantasy. That's why I'm doing this. I'm trying to let people know, this is, it's a 180. It's nothing like this in real life.
Yep. Right. Absolutely.
All right. So, I'll be in touch, my man. I appreciate the time. Yeah. It's funny, really. I had so many big, grandiose plans for who my first interview was going to be on the show. And you think about this stuff because everybody's interviewing somebody on podcasting. And it's apparently a big deal. And boom. Joe Nascio is my first interview. Unscripted, unplanned. You get to hear the raw intel. What's better than that? right? Do you want to hear all these cuts, these people? They leave some of the best stuff on the cutting room floor. What the hell's the point of talking to somebody if you can't get the real person and what they want to say? You just heard it. This guy dropped a bomb on these guys. And it's funny. It's uncanny. It echoes exactly what I've been saying to you guys. It's nice to hear from somebody else. You may feel the same way. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking to myself over here. Nacho's a survivor. God bless him. God bless his family, what he's gone through. Also gives you a rare glimpse of what the hell these people are up to. I've watched some other interviews from CEOs and things like that. Nobody has said what he just said. He fucking dropped a bank safe on these guys. That's a home run. If you're a young journalist out there and you're listening to this, that's a home run interview. And everything comes together. Perfect example. Don't fuck around. Pick up the phone. Get off your ass. Make something happen. Don't sit around and plan stuff out and sketch stuff out. Just do it. Shake the trees. Rustle the bushes. Cause some fucking trouble out there. This is how we're going to put ourselves in a better position to change things. Why haven't I heard this guy's story like that before? I don't know. It's incredible. And people thought FISA abuse and illegal surveillance started in 2016. He takes us back to 2001. Tell me again how we're not all being played.